Hello, this is Todd Durakan with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated Tuesday, November 27th, 2018. We'll begin today's reading on the front page with the article titled History in the Air. This is under the Architecture section. Look up and enjoy the view. Decatur is full of high-rise buildings with stories of their own. We researched records to find the tallest occupied structures in the city based on feet. Visit herald-review.com to check out more photos of the big buildings. Photos by Jim Bowling, Herald and Review, source Macon County Property Records, Herald and Review Archives, and Emporis.com. There's a photograph of the Tate and Lyle Building, 210 feet tall. The iconic building at 2200 East El Dorado Street was constructed in 1930. The neo-Gothic headquarters of A.E. Staley Manufacturing Company was known as the Castle in the Cornfields. It now houses Tate and Lyle. Next, we have the Barnes Citizens Building, 161 feet tall, the 13-story building on North Water and East William Streets, overlooks Central Park. It was built in 1930 on what had been a Masonic Lodge temple and was previously known as the Citizens National Bank Building. Next, we have Illinois Power Building, 105 feet tall. The 6-story structure at 134 East Main Street in downtown Decatur was constructed in 1910. It housed the hardware business Morehouse and Wells and then Illinois Power Company, which relocated in 1957. The first floor has been occupied by restaurants, most recently Tandoor Indian Grill. Next, we have One Main Place, 104 feet tall. Opened in 1915, the brick structure at 101 South Main Street, overlooking Lincoln Square, is 8 stories high. It was also known as Beresford Plaza and the St. Nicholas Hotel. Next up, Macon County Courthouse, 96 feet tall. This structure at 253 East Wood Street dates to 1939 and is 7 stories high. A statue of President Abraham Lincoln is outside the building. And finally, we have the Millican Bank Building at 93 feet tall. The brick facade building at 100 South Water Street was constructed in 1914 and is 6 stories high. It previously was known as the Standard Office Building. More of Decatur's tallest structures, the Belvedere Center Plaza, 225 West Wood Street, 116 feet tall, St. Mary's Hospital, 1800 East Lakeshore Drive, 103 feet tall, Macon County Office Building, 141 South Main Street, 103 feet tall, and Orlando Apartments, 156 South Water Street, 86 feet tall. Moving on to the next article on the front page, this is Election 2019, plenty of choices for city voters. 4 seeking mayor spot, 7 for council. This article is by Tom Lissy. From Decatur, 4 candidates are running for mayor and 7 for spots on the Decatur City Council in next spring's municipal election, meaning voters will not have to go to the polls for a February primary. Incumbent Mayor Julie Moore Wolf, who has held the office since 2015, will face 3 challengers: marketing executive Kara Demergian Huss, Councilman David Horn, and Jacob Jenkins, an employee at the Illinois Department of Human Services. For the 3 available council seats, incumbents Lisa Gregory and Bill Faber will face 5 challengers: retiree Marty Watkins, accountant Siobhan Francis, Taylorville Correctional Center warden Shalith Hansbrough, Skywalker International Sports Complex CEO Rodney Walker, and auto shop owner John Phillips Jr. Councilwoman Dr. Dana Ray opted to step down at the end of her term. A February 21st primary would only have been triggered if at least 5 candidates made it on the mayoral ballot, or at least 10 for the city council. The deadline to file paperwork to get on the ballot was 5 p.m. Monday. However, it will be several weeks before a final ballot emerges. That's because there are several administrative steps before the city clerk gives county officials a final version of the names, due December 20th, that will appear on the April 6th election. First, residents can file objections to any candidate's petitions in the next week, triggering a review of the information and the signatures of eligible voters that were submitted according to state law. Then there's the issue of what order names will appear on the ballot for both offices. Assuming no petitions are successfully challenged, City Clerk Kim Althoff said Demirjian Huss's name will appear first on the ballot for mayor, since she filed her petition first. Jenkins, who filed last, will appear under Moore Wolf and Horn in that order. But Althoff will conduct a lottery to determine whether Watkins or Francis will appear first in the city council race. Both turned in their petitions during the first hour they could be filed. Because no one filed after 4 p.m. on Monday, there will be no lotteries for whose name appears last. Walker, who filed just after 3 p.m., would appear last. The prevailing wisdom in ballot strategy, according to Althoff, is the last is better than second to last. Some people want to be the last on the ballot if they're not first on the ballot, Althoff said. The lottery must take place by December 5th, according to state law. The last incumbent to file his petition forms was Councilman Bill Faber on Monday, who also announced his candidacy the same day. It takes a while to learn the ropes on the city council, kind of like how, in riding a horse, it takes a while to develop a deep seat, Faber said. I think having 4 years to learn the ropes, I can bring that background experience to our decisions. Faber, a private attorney in Decatur, has been a vocal critic of city leaders and often dissenter in council votes since he won his seat in 2015. After losing in two prior runs for city office. During the last city election, Faber publicly endorsed Moore Wolf's opponent, John Phillips Sr., over his disapproval of former city manager Tim Gleason, who left that post in July for the same position in Bloomington. And we have a sidebar story here. On the ballot, the following candidates filed petitions for city offices by the 5 p.m. Monday deadline. Mayor Julie Moore Wolf, incumbent, Kara Demirjian Huss, marketing executive, David Horn, councilman and biology professor, Jacob Jenkins, Illinois DHS employee, City Council, 3 seats, Lisa Gregory, incumbent, Bill Faber, incumbent, Marty Watkins, retiree, Siobhan Francis, accountant, Shalith Hansbro, correction facility warden, John Phillips Jr., auto shop owner, Rodney Walker, sports complex owner and coach. All right, we move on to the next page. In the local section, shooting suspect arrested by Tony Reed from Decatur. A Decatur man accused of flagging down a passing motorist, asking him odd questions, and then shooting and wounding him as he tried to drive away, has been arrested. Marcus E. Flagg, 21, was taken into custody Thursday and booked on a preliminary charge of aggravated battery with a firearm, which is subject to review by the Macon County State's Attorney's Office. A sworn Decatur police affidavit said the crime dates to July 15th, when police were called at 2:30 a.m. to the intersection of North Warren Street and East Grand Avenue in response to a shooting. The adult male victim said he was driving just minutes earlier through the intersection of North Warren and East Stewart Streets when he was flagged down by a man, the affidavit said. He stated the male leaned into the passenger side of his vehicle and began to ask him questions, the affidavit said. The driver stated that he became concerned at the questioning. He stated the man then produced a handgun and pointed it at him. The driver stated that he grabbed for the gun as he started to drive away. As he did, the man fired the handgun, striking him in the hand and bicep. On July 28th, the affidavit said police were called to the 300 block of East Stewart Street in response to shots fired alert and traced the gunfire to an address in that block. They seized a .40 caliber handgun that matched the caliber of the spent shell found in the victim's car. Police developed information that eventually pointed to Flagg, who was at the address where the gun was found. As the shooting suspect, the affidavit said he was later identified in a digital picture lineup by the victim. Flagg remained in the Macon County Jail on Monday night in lieu of $150,000 bond. Continuing with local and state news, page A3, home invasion arrests made. Report details attack on Decatur couple. Tony Reed, Decatur. Sworn police affidavits have revealed more of the motive and violent details surrounding a string of three Decatur home invasions in which armed men went in search of guns and cash to steal. Affidavits from police Detective James Canarium describe how Rahim A. Shabazz, 18, and a 16-year-old juvenile were driving around the night of November 20th, complaining they had warrants out for their arrest. They were riding with their friends and fellow accused home invasion accomplices, Dondrian L. Austin, 18, and 19-year-old Byron D. Theus, and decided they would get some guns and money before going to jail, Canarium said. The detective said they struck first at 7:40 p.m. in the 400 block of Shadow Lane, where they burst into the home of a man and his wife. Canarium said the man was hit in the back of the head with a handgun, and the man's wife was clubbed to the ground after she tried to run screaming from the house. She told police all five suspects, the group includes an as-yet unidentified suspect, were armed. Her husband said he was walked by three of the suspects to a bedroom where they told him, "Give me your money and guns," Canarium said. The men grabbed a .22 caliber handgun, $400 in cash, and three cell phones, valued at more than $1,100 before fleeing. The affidavits describe the other two home invasions in less detail, but said the gang struck again in the 1800 block of North Summit Avenue barely 15 minutes later. Just before 10 p.m., they struck a third time, targeting a home in the 400 block of North 33rd Street, but police had been alerted, and Canarium said they were waiting to chase down four of the armed men as they tried to flee the scene. Police said they recovered eight guns during their investigation. Theus, Austin, and Shabazz were all booked on preliminary charges of home invasion, armed robbery, and aggravated battery, all subject to review by the Macon County State's Attorney's Office. Court documents say bail was set for Austin and Shabazz at $25,000 each and $10,000 for Theus. The juvenile was petitioned to court and is being held in a juvenile detention facility. Continuing on with local news, guilty plea in Frozen Dog's Death by Tony Reed, Decatur. Shamar Q. Dawson was sentenced to a 12-month conditional discharge and banned from being a caregiver of any animal after pleading guilty to allowing his pet dog to freeze to death in Decatur. Dawson, 24, accepted a deal negotiated by his assistant public defender, Matthew Butler, that saw him plead guilty November 20th to a charge of cruelty to animals, a Class A misdemeanor. Conditional discharge is a non-reporting probation in which the conduct of the defendant is reviewed at the end of the period to see that the requirements have been met. Dawson appeared in Macon County Circuit Court and was also sentenced to 30 days in the Macon County Jail, but will serve no extra time because he was given 30 days credit for a previous 30-day sentence. That had been opposed at a hearing on October 11th in an unrelated case that saw Dawson plead guilty to harassment of a witness, a Class 3 felony. He also was sentenced to 1 year conditional discharge in that case, and the year's conditional discharge in the dog case was ordered to run concurrently with it. The animal cruelty case dates to January 9th, when Dawson's pet pit bull, Mary Jane, was found frozen to death in her doghouse. Dawson admitted dragging the dead dog in its doghouse to the backyard of another Decatur home. But in a Herald and Review interview shortly after he was charged, he said he had just been in shock after finding the dog's body and wasn't trying to cover up the crime. Dawson said he had fallen on hard times and Mary Jane and another pit bull, Guy, were being looked after by a friend. Dawson said the friend wasn't cruel to the dogs and they had been checked on every day. He said he had gone out of his way to care for them. There had been some days when they ate and I didn't. That is no exaggeration, he said at the time. However, a criminal complaint filed by Macon County Animal Control asserted Mary Jane had been dead for 2 weeks before her body was found, an allegation Dawson disputed. In addition to the conditional discharge and being banned from being an animal caregiver, Dawson was ordered to perform 50 hours of community service. On to the next article on the local page, Decatur Woman Killed in Crash, by Jalen Cook from Springfield. A 29-year-old Decatur woman was killed in a single-vehicle crash on eastbound Interstate 72 early Saturday morning, the Sangamon County Coroner's Office said Monday. Coroner Cinda Edwards said in a news release that Marche Robinson was pronounced dead at the scene of the crash, which was just east of Springfield. Robinson was a rear-seat passenger in the vehicle, she said. Illinois State Police said in a news release that preliminary investigations show that at about 3:15 a.m. Saturday, the eastbound vehicle drove off the right side of the roadway, spun 180 degrees, and struck a tree. The 27-year-old driver and a 22-year-old passenger, also from Decatur, were taken to an area hospital and treated for serious injuries. Edwards said an autopsy was conducted in Springfield on Monday morning, and preliminary indications were Robinson's death was caused by injuries she suffered in the crash. Further lab testing is pending, she said. Police said any charges in the crash are pending further investigation. And we'll move on to the education section. This next article is called "Tis the Season for Art. John Hill Students Highlight Talents with Downtown Displays." This article is by Valerie Wells from Decatur. Dell's Popcorn Shop on Merchant Street is appropriately festive for the holiday season, thanks to art students from John Hill's Magnet School. John Hill is an arts-focused school, and fine arts are integrated into every grade level, kindergarten through eighth, said art teacher Kathy Balamo-Scanley. The middle school students decorated the windows at Dell's for Halloween and wanted to do it again for Christmas. It was so cold, eighth grader Dylan Briscoe said. It took about 2 hours, but we took breaks in between. Dell's is a community project, Ganley said. One of our teachers was in conversation with the owner, Kemper Wilcutt II, and he said he would be interested in having our art students come down and create a mural display in his window, and he was thrilled about the idea. I worked with a group of middle school students, she continued. We had planning sessions, and we integrated the planning concepts they learned in class, things like symmetry and balance, and utilizing shapes with real objects. The snowy scene is not necessarily just a Christmas scene. It's more of a generalized winter theme. It really did become a lesson in making mural displays, Ganley said. Before Thanksgiving, the students put the finishing touches on their entry for Christmas Card Lane, an outdoor display based on the theme Holiday Season Around the World, downtown in the grassy area west of the ADM Center until December 24th. The community can choose a favorite and vote at www.decaturarts.org/vote. Christmas Card Lane is a Decatur Area Arts Council project sponsored by Dynagraphics and Huff Lumber and Home Specialties. Entrants include local artists, businesses, and other schools. First prize is $200, second prize is $100, and third prize is $50. We want to incorporate all the holidays, Ella Redden said, as she and her classmates painted the giant Christmas card now on display in Holiday Season Around the World. The design was created by eighth graders Isabella Carunas and Cassie Schaefer and includes a toy soldier, a Christmas tree, a globe, and poinsettias. All the middle school students had a hand in the project, however, and if the Johns Hill entry wins, the students have agreed to donate their prize to the school's arts program. Our objective is just to create a lesson for the students, to get some more community involvement, Ganley said, and to help people just be aware that we're an arts integrated magnet school. And there are a few photos, two photos in fact, that accompany this story. A beautiful large one of five students painting the mural. Johns Hill Magnet School students work on the group's contribution to the Decatur Arts Area Arts Council's Christmas Card Lane event. It's one of the ways the school is highlighting its art focus in downtown Decatur. And then there's a photo of Dell's Popcorn Shop. Students painted a winter scene on the window of Dell's Popcorn Shop on Merchant Street. And on to the last article on this page, Discovery Recount Set in Sheriff's Race. Process Could Lay Groundwork for Full Recount in Sheriff's Race, by Ryan Voiles from Decatur. The first step in a possible recount in the Macon County Sheriff's Race is set to begin at 8 a.m. Friday, County Clerk Steve Bean said Monday. Republican Jim Root, who lost by one vote to Democrat Tony Brown, is seeking a discovery recount, which is non-binding and can be used to gather evidence to petition a court for a full recount. After provisional and mail-in ballots were counted November 20th, Brown finished with 19,655 votes to Root's 19,654. The final results came 2 weeks after election night, when Root had a 99-vote advantage over Brown with early voting and day of ballots counted. The discovery recount allows Root to review ballot applications, voter affidavits, ballots, voting machines, or ballots in up to 25% of Macon County's 72 precincts. Per Root's request, he will review 17 precincts. None of the precincts requested by Root are in Decatur Township, which holds 34 of the county's 72 precincts and went for Brown. Instead, Root will review precincts from the surrounding communities such as Forsyth, Mount Zion, Long Creek, and Harristown, which voted overwhelmingly for Republicans in this month's election. A petition for a full recount must be filed in civil court within 30 days from today, which is the last day for the Illinois State Board of Elections to canvass the results of an election. A judge would hear evidence from both sides about whether a recount is necessary and could rule to let the recount go forward or let the election results stand. State law said that a discovery recount cannot prevent the process of an election. While the process continues, Bean said Brown is considered the winner of the race, and barring legal intervention, he will be sworn in as sheriff by next Monday. Macon County State's Attorney Jay Scott said any petition for a full recount would have to be filed as a civil case in Macon County. Like any other civil case, Scott said, attorneys from both sides could file motions, submit evidence, and perform discovery. That could lead to a drawn-out process. I think it would be expedited under the circumstances, but it's not something that's going to happen overnight, he said. Unless the court determines the election results should be changed, Scott said Brown will remain as sheriff. Costs for the recount from discovery on are covered by the party requesting it, according to the Illinois State Board of Elections. There are no statutes that allow the petitioner to recoup the costs. Brown and Root have insisted the drawing out of the election process would not damage their professional relationship as law enforcement officers or harm the sheriff's office. There's an article about the economy. GM plans layoffs and plant closings. Restructuring reflects industry's move away from car production, by Tom Krischer, Associated Press from Detroit. General Motors will cut up to 14,000 workers in North America and put five plants up for possible closures as it abandons many of its car models and restructures to focus more on autonomous and electric vehicles, the automaker said Monday. The reductions could amount to as much as 8% of GM's global workforce of 180,000 employees. The restructuring reflects changing North American auto markets as manufacturers continue to shift away from cars toward SUVs and trucks. In October, almost 65% of new vehicles sold in the U.S. were trucks or SUVs. That figure was about 50% cars just 5 years ago. GM is shedding cars largely because it doesn't make money on them, city analyst Ite McCallie wrote in a note to investors. We estimate sedans operate at a significant loss, hence the need for classic restructuring, he wrote. The reduction includes about 8,000 white-collar employees, or 15% of GM's North American white-collar workforce. Some will take buyouts, while others will be laid. At the factories, around 3,300 blue-collar workers could lose their jobs in the U.S. and another 2,600 in Canada, but some U.S. workers could transfer to truck or SUV factories that are increasing production. The cuts mark GM's first major downsizing since shedding thousands of jobs in the Great Recession. The company also said it will stop operating two additional factories outside North America by the end of next year, in addition to a previously announced plant closure in Gunsan, South Korea. General Motor Company's preemptive strike to get leaner before the next downturn likely will be followed by Ford Motor Company, which has said it is restructuring and will lay off an unspecified number of white-collar workers. Toyota Motor Corp also has discussed cutting costs, even though it's building a new assembly plant in Alabama. GM isn't the first to abandon much of its car market. Fiat Chrysler Automobiles got out of the small and mid-sized car market 2 years ago, while Ford announced plans to shed all cars but the Mustang sports car in the U.S. in the coming years. The layoffs come amid the backdrop of a trade war between U.S., China, and Europe that will likely lead to higher prices for imported vehicles and those exported from the U.S. GM CEO Mary Barra said the company faces challenges from tariffs, but she did not directly link the layoffs to them. GM doesn't foresee an economic downturn and is making the cuts to get in front of it while the company is strong and while the economy is strong, Barra told reporters. Factories that could be closed include assembly plants in Detroit and Oshawa, Ontario, and Lordstown, Ohio, as well as transmission plants in Warren, Michigan, and near Baltimore. The announcement worried GM workers who could lose their jobs. I don't know how I'm going to feed my family, Matt Smith, a worker at the Ontario factory, said Monday, outside the plant's south gate, where workers block trucks from entering or leaving. It's hard. It's horrible. Smith's wife also works at the plant. The couple has an 11-month-old at home. Workers at the Ontario plant walked off the job Monday, but were expected to return Tuesday. After the morning announcement, Barra was to head to Washington to speak with White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow in what was described as a previously scheduled meeting, according to a White House official who spoke on the condition of anonymity because the official was not authorized to discuss the meeting publicly. President Donald Trump, who has made bringing back auto jobs a big part of his appeal to Ohio and other Great Lakes states that are crucial to his reelection, said his administration and lawmakers are exerting a lot of pressure on GM. Trump said he was being told tough on Barra. He said he told the company that the U.S. has done a lot for GM and that if the cars aren't selling, the company needs to produce ones that will. At a rally near GM's Lordstown, Ohio plant last summer, Trump told people not to sell their homes because the jobs are all coming back. Most of the factories to be affected by GM's restructuring build cars that will not be sold in the U.S. after next year. They could close or they could get different vehicles to build. Their futures will be part of contract talks with the United Auto Workers Union next year. All right, we'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, dated Tuesday, November 27th, 2018. Please stay tuned.